Back Uber alone, all of you, Mrs. Bobbsey cried, at the same time trying to wrest the Landjager from her daughter.
It's just Jellignite, Edith said. It's not dangerous, Mum. Grandpa could blow up the dunny while Ronnie was sitting on the seat.
You could you, Dad? Oh, I've played some pranks. No one ever hurt themselves.
The air was unstable, and Mrs. Bobbsey's lips were set thin and tight with rage.
Dad, she said, outside, now, chat.
The god of the wind put up his fists.
You want to fight like a man?
Mrs. Bobbsey held wide the flywire door.
Please, Dad, please.
When you're in the Red X, you'll wish you were experienced with jelly. Mrs. Bobbsey let the door swing shut again.
How do you mean? What about the Red X?
I might be your competitor.
You wouldn't dare.
I was in car trials before you were even born. Mrs. Bobbsey sat down.
You're not in the Red X.
The old man offered a tight, wide grin. We'll be friendly competitors. Can't you just leave Titch alone?
I was talking to me mate, Murray. He was in last year's Red X. He swears by the Jellignite I gave him.
Let us have a life, Dad.
Murray reckons the road from Cloncurry has a stretch about 80 miles long. So bloody narrow, and if a car breaks down ahead of you, you're stuffed without a stick of jelly.
Take a carton. Learn how to clear the road. I understand you're nervous, he said to Mrs. Bobbsey.
Get off his back. This won't hurt anyone. All you do is hurt.
I've been doing it for years. You can throw jelly in the fire and jump on it. It's got to be detonated. So you've got your jelly with a poker the size of a pencil up the middle of it, and then you buy the detonators. They're the dangerous things, he said to Ronnie as he came back through the door. Dets, they call them. Keep those things apart and you're okay.
The god of the wind laid a second stick of Jellignite on the kitchen table.
Play with it, he said to Mrs. Gleason. Go on, give it a whirl.
Ronnie took immediate possession of the Jellignite and danced around the room, hitting himself on the head until his mother slapped his legs, and he dropped the Jellignite and ran away in tears.
I will clean the fish, I said.
I'll help, said Beverly. They must have a knife.
I had no choice but to stand close beside her as she turned her attention to a kitchen drawer. Her shoulders smelled of coconut, and I pointed out a wooden-handled knife, and she placed it in my palm and closed my hand around it. The children were sent out of the room, and I set to clean the fish standing at the table. Mrs. Bobbsey was in the garden. Dan explained Jellignite to Beverly, who signalled her understanding step by step. Just the same, it was she who went to find the flour for dredging.
I made a sharp cut along each side of the spine. I caught the dorsal fin between thumb and blade, and then, like a faith healer, held it in the air. Then I drove my fingers into its body and lifted out all the flesh and peeled the skin away like a sock off a foot. And I paused a second as Mrs. Gleason excused herself to Dangerous Dan. She took the fillet from me and dredged the sweet white flesh in flour. Feel the weight, I thought, not certain what was happening now. It was impossible.
Chapter 22. We had days and days of fuss and bother. Buck Hooper passed his driver's test at Bacchus Marsh Police Station, where they asked him what colour an orange was. He helped deliver new cars to customers and was useful in many ways, although not always available when we wanted him. Finally, it was revealed he had been at the library in Melbourne, researching the Red X route, particularly the road north of Rockhampton, because, he said, none of us had ever driven it. This was a presumption, but correct. After dinner, he produced maps and notebooks. My sister was stimulated beyond all decency. Now she had a bloody pointer.
This is of more than academic interest,
he said. Titch fastened on to academic. As a matter of academic interest, he would ask Buck Hooper, who never knew his leg was pulled. The Red X certainly gave my husband something to look forward to, but as a matter of academic interest, I also love to drive. Sometimes I fretted I would be left behind. On sleepless nights, I imagined myself speeding across the floodplain Buck Hooper described, the Brigalow scrub, the flying rocks kicked up by other cars. This was my adventure on the Crystal Highway, named for all the broken windscreen glass scattered along the verges. It was corrugated, gutted, crossed by creeks. When we heard it was also known as the Horror Stretch, we assumed it was on account of the road conditions. Buck Hooper did not suggest otherwise until the kiddies were all in bed. Then he gave it to us. No holds barred. Titch left his beer untouched as he listened to these sickening stories. "This really true?" he asked. Beverly nodded vigorously. I thought, what would she know? Buck Hooper said families had been forced off cliff tops, gunned down, babies brained with clubs. At Gulbulba, more than 300 people had been shot or drowned, which was called a dispersal. This really happened? No, it was black people. It happened centuries ago. To me, it was like a horror in the Bible. It was not from our modern time. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known man by lying with him. God help me, cried Titch, who would get upset listening to the story of the crucifixion. What use is this to us? He gave his full attention to the 180 miles through the Kimberley, from Mardawarra to Halls Creek. 8 pages of strip maps, each sheet depicting a vertical black snake of track, cut by fine straight lines, and warnings of heavy sand and water crossings, and gates across the road. We know which way the gates open, cried Beverly, as if she made the map herself, as if she had flown on her broomstick 2,000 miles across the Red Desert to the Kimberley, as if she understood the significance to us drivers who must confront these time-consuming obstacles. Just the same, if we knew which way they opened, we would also know exactly where to stop, reverse, go forward. Well, blow me down, my husband said. You clever bugger, Buck Hooper. How do you know this? The postman? Buck Hooper's eyes crinkled at my husband, and I thought, he'll be the navigator, and I'll be home being mummy. I admit to feeling double-crossed by Titch. At that stage, everyone was in love with Buck Hooper, including, I have to say, my sister. At night, we could hear them through the fibro walls, across the drive. Of course, it was nothing to do with us, but we were the married couple, and all the stress and tension of the Red X had dampened our affections. How sad it was to lie there, on our backs, not touching. I thought he had betrayed me. He rolled away, and I mourned those years we had held each other all night long, our good life which we wrecked by bringing the Red X into bed. I could feel Titch beside me, wide awake, not liking me, but wanting me. Beverly and Buck Hooper woke me up. It was 4 in the morning, and I went to the kitchen and made tea. Sooner or later, she would go sneaking back into her caravan. I opened the back door and waited. A moorpork cried. The moon crept from behind a cloud. A smudgy cat stalked mice among the canna lilies. Finally, I heard the soft pat of Buck Hooper's flywire door, and then the rusty hinge of the garden gate. I turned on our back light, so she would see me walk along the path to the laundry, and wait beside the copper. She arrived barefoot, carrying her dirty, bunched-up stockings. Her makeup was smeary. She had ratty bird's nest hair. I took the stockings from her and laid them in the concrete tub in silence. He's very frail, I warned her. Anyone can see that. Frail? She smirked. He's 26 years old. He's been hurt. Poor Irene, my sister said. I'm sorry. And I was reminded of why I always fought with her. I had wanted an older sister who might have looked after me, but that had never been the case, and she would always take what she could get and put me down. I suggested she would be better having her social life off the premises. She stared. I stared back. Once upon a time, I would have pulled her hair. All right, she said at last. She fled across the gravel to the caravan, and I was left with just her filthy stockings. The very next day, she began to make a contribution to the household. She shopped, she cooked, she swept the builder's sawdust off the new showroom floor and removed the Pilkington stickers from the plate glass windows. She was not going to be denied Buck Hoover. That must have been the basis of her thinking. She was still annoying, of course, but now she helped the kids with their school projects. The Melbourne Argus had produced colour supplements for the royal visit, and Beverly got down on the living room floor with cartridge paper and a pot of homemade paste, cutting out pictures of the royal crown, the sceptre, and the orb. She also had her hair done so as to solicit comments on her physical similarity to the royal person. She and the boys dug a pit in the middle of the back lawn, without permission. Here she cooked a lamb on hot stones, as had been described in the Women's Weekly as Māori style. This never cooked right through, but fair is fair. She was earning her keep. Buck Hooper then encouraged her to believe she was an expert on maps. He allowed her to lecture us on the Australian Map Compendium. I admit this contained curiosities, not least the map with Australia at the top and Europe at the bottom. Also explorers' maps with Bass Strait missing and Tasmania joined to the mainland. The Maslin map of the inland sea and the entire country shown as a quilt of pastoral leases.
It's as educational as a dictionary, Titch said.
But he never did like education. Also, we had to listen to them from our bedroom. That made me sad, and I tried to show Titch how I loved him, how he was always, forever my husband. But we failed somehow. In the dark, I heard him say, "I've seen how you look at him." I did not dignify that with an answer. All night, my mind was full of Red X. I thought about the Holden air cleaner, which would clog with outback dust. I decided I would put the kiddies into boarding school. In the morning, I was ashamed. I took Beverly's filthy stockings, put them in my handbag, and drove down to the part of Simon's garage, which was becoming our new showroom. I lifted the bonnet, and there was that bloody air cleaner, a big black cylinder with a wingnut on the top. I wasn't even in overalls, just a pleated grey skirt and blue cardi, and I could feel the apprentice watching me, wondering what was the silly woman doing. In actual fact, the silly woman was being a genius. She unscrewed the central wingnut and lifted off the lid, removed the mesh cylinder, detached the main unit from the valve cover, poured the oil away, tucked her lovely linen hanky into the open carby, washed the filter and main unit in petrol. Then, everything being shiny clean, she retrieved her hanky, stretched her sister's dirty stocking over the cylindrical mesh, and, Bob's your uncle, reassembled an air cleaner that would do the job. I found the silent apprentice by my side. He asked, "Does your husband know what you're doing?" Being a man, he will have forgotten that by now.
Chapter 23. The Bob's boy lay on the backyard grass looking at the sky. I knew exactly how he felt, or so I thought, watching a transport plane drone through the clear, unclouded sky. This was the utter desolation which colonized my childhood afternoons. This sadness was always lurking, and could be triggered by something as inconsequential as small black ants,
beings with no possible knowledge of my existence, hurrying across a concrete slab with what purpose? Who could know? I felt a similar sadness exploring my grandmother's musty atlas, those patchwork European nations whose lovely reds and violets were my natural home. Then Germany declared war on me. We Lutherans were loyal subjects of the British Empire, but my older brother was excited by his German blood. You could see his muscles fighting with themselves. He was lean like the pastor, but much taller and stronger, and his constant rage left his neck pushed forward. He bought a motorcycle and rode to meetings. He celebrated Hitler's birthday by marching up and down the main street in Handorf. He spat a great bubbling tarry mess on our framed portrait of the King of England and dared to smile while my father prevented my grandmother, frail and pale as china, from cleaning up his crime. I wet my bed. I was compelled to fight at school. My father wrote away for the 1943 National Geographic map of the world, which he imagined might bring me peace of mind. By the time that arrived, the war was over, and Carl had finally, after so much effort on his part, become one of the two native-born South Australians to be interned. My parents suffered him, then I added to their pain, fleeing our home without a word of farewell or explanation. I think of this most days. My life was fear and chaos. But when I arrived in Melbourne, it was to maps I turned as to a parent. When I entered Sebastian Lasky's office, I thrust the door wide and closed it so energetically that Tyndale's precious sketch maps rose into the air and sailed perilously close to the open window. "Willy, Willy," he called to me when he heard my name. I doubt I ever showed such energy again. Sebastian was the map librarian of the State Library of Victoria. Such was the library in those years, when there were no proper cataloguing guidelines and very few shelves to accommodate the library's treasures. It is likely that this grand title was one Sebastian had granted to himself. He was a broad-chested man with legs like fence posts, which he displayed bare in all weathers, even when there was frost upon suburban lawns. He had a long jaw and wide, high cheeks, and close-cropped silver hair and an ugly scar stretching from the corner of his mouth almost to his eye. I imagined him a warrior who had been compelled, by some failure or disgrace, to be reduced to this sedentary role. Sebastian hired me to be his assistant. Lord knows what he might have finally taught me if I had not fled again, this time from Adelina, who was the reason I ran away from Adelaide in the first place. I was 21 years old. Sebastian briefly loved me, I think, in the way of childless men. He shared his reading of maps such as Willem Blau's Terra Sancta Que in Sacris Terra Promissionis Olim Palestina, which his erudition layered with the ghosts of other charts, including population movements, abstracting the cruel invasion of the Homo sapiens into the lands later fought over by Christians, Jews, and Muslims. In those faded sepias, I saw the extinction of the Neanderthals, who had been moved not through any restless desire to explore the world, but by the need to flee a ruthless enemy. I had only known him for a week when I asked him to help me with the crisis that had caused us to flee from South Australia. Where else might I have turned? What other reckless path might I have chosen? I requested a loan of £50 to procure an illegal abortion. Sebastian brought Adelina and me home to meet his wife. We must have appeared to them as orphans, as indeed we were. They fed us soup with spoons so large We could barely fit them in our mouths. It was to Sebastian I divulged not only my guilts and agonies, but the unsettling emotions engendered in me by maps. This was grief, he said. He offered Jung. I feel very strongly that I am under the influence of things or questions which were left incomplete and unanswered by my parents and grandparents and more distant ancestors. It often seems as if there were an impersonal karma within a family which is passed on from parents to children. It has always seemed to me that I had to answer questions which fate had posed my forefathers and which had not yet been answered, or as if I had to complete or perhaps continue things which previous ages had left unfinished. My father never learned where I had vanished to. I owed him so much more. Sebastian drove us to the abortionists in his rusty Hillman Minx and then delivered us home again. He left us with a pot of stew and dumplings. In that blessed time I was his protégé, and he introduced me to beer and his opinions of the relative virtues of both Freud and Jung, which I remember as the subject of our conversations at the Albion Hotel in Carlton. Here, every Friday afternoon, when I was still a happily married young man, I learned much of value, including the error of standing on an ashtray, which might close around my ankle as fiercely as a rabbit trap. It was at the Albion that I heard him say, "Don't give an old digger the shits," because how else would anyone know this odd foreigner had fought for Australia in the war? It was established I had no head for alcohol and must stop at one. Those 7 fluid ounces lifted my inhibitions sufficiently to reveal things to Sebastian I had never told a living soul. He seemed astonished to hear I sometimes became a river in a dream. He asked permission to make notes. Who else on earth would have talked to me like this? Through Sebastian, I understood that Freud had mistakenly thought the unconscious is the filing cabinet for those repressed sexual desires which cause pathological or mental illness. But it was Jung who was his man. That was my good fortune, he said. It would have been traumatic to confess my snake dreams to the opposition, but a Jungian could recognize them as blessings. My giant snake was a reflection of the omnipotent and omnipresent power of God that lives within every human. My snakes often had whiskers which caused him to clutch me to his bosom, and such was his strength and size, no one in the aggressively heterosexual Albion dared say a word. Freud thought religion was an escape and a fallacy, Sebastian said. The correct view was the total opposite. Religion was a direct line between all peoples, from us to blacks and others known as savages. Although all religions differed, he said, the archetypes and symbols remained the same. Your snake is not your penis, he said. It is a god. With hindsight, I suspect he was a member of the Polish aristocracy. How astonishing that I never asked. I ignorantly imagined his wound was a war injury when it was clearly a dueling scar from Heidelberg or Bonn. He was from an old family, I suppose, and had carried those huge soup spoons across the earth for some reason I could never know. He told me that Jung had dreamed the First World War in November 1913 before it started. The great man had dreamed a map, in fact, a great flood and the death of thousands. He saw blood covering the northern and low-lying lands between the North Sea and the Alps. He saw mighty yellow waves the floating rubble of civilization, uncounted drowned bodies in a sea of blood. I remember coming out of the Albion one yellow winter evening. I can still see the corner of Lygon and Faraday Streets, and still retain whole sentences of Sebastian's recitation. I've searched, but never found them on the page. Did he invent them himself? Was my mentor possibly unhinged? That afternoon was in June 1950. Sebastian and his diminutive wife were two of our three good friends in Melbourne, the other being Madison Lee, the first male nurse and the first black man I ever knew. What a rarity Madison was in that year, when the White Australia policy was in full effect. A few years previously, the government had dithered about letting black GIs come ashore, but Madison had been granted residence as a person of distinguished merit, which he claimed was a misunderstanding. The truth, Adelina said, was that he had saved an Australian general's son. In any case, he worked the same shift as Adelina. He was her friend and my friend. He cooked spicy dishes from Louisiana using yabbies from Merai Creek. That must have been étouffée, although we had never heard of such a thing. He sang, too, after dinner in the East Melbourne flat. His Mona Lisa was better than Nat King Cole's. Once or twice he brought a girl around, but his manner was that of a dedicated bachelor. I mean, his grace, his delicacy, his exquisite cleanliness, and the pain and yearning of his velvet voice. I was relieved he was there when Adelina's waters broke, and comforted that he came with us to the hospital. He was my companion in the waiting room, where we ate meat pies and drank Fanta with all the careless innocence of boys. But then the gowned obstetrician emerged, and it was clear immediately something had gone wrong. I saw it on the doctor's narrow sculpted face, a twist, a sort of anger, and I thought, they screwed up, she's dead. I looked at Madison, and he had seen what I had seen. The doctor wished to speak to me. No, he said, alone. I followed him along some corridor, hating his thoughtless squeaky shoes. I don't know where we went. Was it an examination room? I remember a bassinet, an unhappy nurse. They both looked at me with awful pity. I thought, I will bring this baby up alone. I will care for it forever. But then I saw that this was not our baby. He was black, with wild black hair. The doctor said he was sorry. My head was filled with storm and sand. I left the room and was lost inside the hospital. I emerged in a kitchen, and then the street, and the cruel tram lines were wet with summer rain. I was a moving storm of rage and grief, a willy-willy, 21 years old, about to perform an action which would take a second and last a lifetime. Part 2. Sydney to Townsville, 1,300 miles.
Chapter 1. In 2 weeks, the Reddicks cars would depart from Sydney. Thus, we moved from a private simmer to a very public boil. Our showroom was a work in progress, a temple to Reddicks car number 92. Once a polite suburban vehicle, our demo had become a brutal beast, four-eyed with mesh-protected headlights. We fitted a massive bull bar and applied the decals for Caltrex and SPC bearings. Titch worked off the floor, taking orders in his spivvy charcoal suit. No one seemed to understand I might be a driver too. The car was bound to break a spring or two. To fit a new one would lose us points. At night it was back to overalls and drills, changing tyres, replacing leaf springs. At night my husband did his Marine Corps exercises in his underpants, and I lay in bed and watched him, and wondered how much money would persuade Beverly to stay with the kids. I lay in the dark and imagined her face, the pleasure it would give her to refuse me. Ah, she had been waiting for this, she claimed when I broached the subject. She understood the trap, she told me. I had used Buck Hoover to keep her in the marsh, and now she would be compelled to be my babysitter. Well, she was sick of Buck Hoover. What did I think of that? I said that was sad, of course. Was I a dummy? She wished to know. Yes, I thought, I was a dummy. I would have to stay at home. What diff does Buck Hoover make? She asked me. Go on, she said. Go and swan around the country. I've got nowhere else to live. Thank you, God. Good, kind Jesus, blessed be thy deliverance. Buck Hoover wore shorts into the colder weather, and my sister was critical of his legs. Titch taught him how to remove the shackle bolt from the leaf spring, put a block of wood between the spring eye and floor, then jack the spring up so the eye moves along the wood to the spot where the shackle can be fitted. I was going to drive. I was really going. I made sure we had spare clips on the second leaves to take the recoil and weight of the back axle when travelling over jump-ups and corrugated roads. The Russian spy defected, and the newspapers were full of photographs of Moscow thugs trying to drag his wife onto an aeroplane. Ben Calvo came running across to the showroom with the latest news, going, "Yes, yes, yes. Don't worry about the Russians. Look at this." It was an attractive woman with her chest stuck out. This was Glenda Cloverdale, the champion of nothing to lose. I would not have trusted her a moment. Apple season ended. I made a huge map of Australia for the showroom, and Beverly stole it from me. "Sorry," she said. "I just think I'd be better at this." Then she took my kids to help her paint it. I was very pleased at first. Ronnie and Edith's cousins finally took an interest in them. Together they painted a window sign, Red X Trial, 1954, in Dayglow orange. They made small green flags to show the progress of car number 92 through Blackfella country, no Holden ever crossed before. I did not like my kiddies cuddling with their aunt, and of course she knew it. But I had got exactly what I wanted, hadn't I? After tea time, local families stood in the dark street, staring through the showroom window, while the kids added details to the map. Grid, gutter, creek crossing, dust bad, etc. I collected shillings for the public telephones along the road. I hid gifts so the kids could discover them every day I was away. Ribbons for Edith, say, or a pretty little ring. I bought a sheriff's badge for Ronnie. I splurged on Sparky's Magic Piano, a real album with 3 10-inch records, 6 sides, a total playing time of 20 minutes. Titch did not want to carry spare tires on the roof, but we had no choice. The extra fuel tank took up too much room. We couldn't help that either. Titch rationed every inch of space. We laughed at Buck Hoover, packing his grandmother's atlas, and a book called Answer to Job. He owned the first drip-dry shirt I ever saw. Dunstan was still in our hair, but I expected we would soon be quit of him. Buck Hoover packed no trousers, only shirts and shorts. He preferred bare feet to sweaty shoes. Ours was the country that had killed the white men who dared to cross it. Poor Burke and Wills and Leichhardt. Now we would face the killer country. We would face roads with dust 2 feet deep. We would circle the whole of our murderous continent in the same car Joe Blow drove to work. We were not pleased to hear Buck Hoover compare us to dogs marking our territory with pee. We were front page in the Bacchus Marsh Express, Titch and me together with all the Holdens we had sold so far. It was a thrill, I admit it. I imagined that was fame. The Melbourne Argus telephoned me. They had a statement from a female competitor known as Granny Conway. "My motto is never touch the engine," she said. "You always strike trouble when you start lifting the bonnet." So would I make a public comment on this nonsense? I refused, and Titch was angry. He said, "Get real, Irene." We were in it for the business. I should be prepared for Sydney, where there would be no denying I was a woman driver. In the business of being written up, of course, Titch was his father's son. And when we finally left the marsh for Sydney, he arranged for a convoy of New Holden owners to follow us out of town, through the Avenue of Honour. He reckoned that might make a story. I wanted the kids to come with us for those first few miles, but then it seemed Edith and Alice Tudbull were making Girl Guide uniforms, and Ronnie and his cousins could not be found. I did not want to let this spoil things. I was not offended that our navigator crawled into the back and studied the Reddix rulebook, as if reading would have us win.
"You'll get carsick," my husband said.
"No, I won't," said Buck Hoover. And in this dull way, the Reddix trial began, as tame and ordinary as a Sunday drive. I did not know what Titch had been up to. We rose from our lovely, fertile valley, and I could not know that I would soon become a wrong'un. Ahead of us was the climb from the flat country up Pretty Sally, a dormant bald volcano, a radiator boiler of a road, with an accident black spot due to a sharp turn near its crest. I was thrilled to feel the go in our engine. There were no freeways, just the Hume Highway with yellow gravel verges, broken fan belts, semi-trailer skid marks. A two-lane track with bridges too narrow for two vehicles to pass. The highway led us through streets of prosperous small towns, Euroa, Violet Town, Benalla, Glenrowan, Wangaratta. We arrived in Yass, in New South Wales, the road chock-full of all-night truckies' cafes and spare parts garages and panel shops.
"See that?"
Buck Hoover said at last. He indicated a signpost. We did not respond.
63 miles to Young. That's Lamming Flat.
Is that a fact?" I never knew about the so-called riots at Lamming Flat. Why would I? They'd occurred a century before, apparently. There had been thousands of Chinese miners just down the road at Lamming Flat.
"Poor buggers," he called them with emotion in his voice.
The nasty white miners had knocked apart the Chinese tents and stolen everything inside. There was gunfire and police saber charges, and one man was left dead. I thought, oh no. I squeezed my husband's hand, but still he stopped the car.
"Get out," Titch told our navigator. "Yes, you. There's something I want you to do for me." "Of course." "Just walk around a bit. Tell me what you see."
I thought, he's going to drive off. He's going to leave Buck Hoover and Yass.
"No, don't," I said.
Titch was waiting behind the wheel. "Please?" I asked. Meanwhile, Buck Hoover was on the footpath, staring in the window of the baker's. Then he was in the middle of the double lines, with the traffic whizzing past each side.
"Pretty town," he said when he came back. "So?"
Titch asked.
"What did you see?" "Nice gold rush buildings," he began. "All the money in the courthouse and the pubs. Any Chinamen?" "Not a one."
And he was grinning, his teeth very white in his tanned face.
"Any blood?" "Not a drop, I'm pleased to say." "You're the navigator," Titch said. "You tell us what is happening now. I could not give a fuck about what happened 100 years ago."
I was embarrassed. I smiled at our poor navigator, so he knew I liked him. Titch pulled back into the traffic.
"I was a chauffeur for a Chinese herbalist," he said. "My father sold him a Model A. Then I lived with the family in Little Bourke Street. Mr. Goon, his name was."
I thought, here it is. One more torture he never told me.
"He was a clever man, the herbalist," my husband said. "He had a little velvet cushion, and he would lay the patient's hand on it and touch it very gently. The goons wanted me to go back to China with him,
If my dad had not needed me, I would have gone. So when you tell me about all that business back there, you haven't got a bloody clue what I think. I've never seen children treated so kindly in all my life. And then I loved him, more than I ever knew I loved him. He had grown up with no mother, been raised by a cruel father. He was a wonder, wresting love from dung. And now he was in the Red X trial. It was impossible. The road markings changed from white to yellow, and we were in another world. We travelled together towards the start, along the rain-slicked narrow highway, beneath clouds like greasy wool, through wide-set sodden winter farms, the unrelenting green of paddocks, the distant mountains of the great dividing range. At Mittagong, 70 miles from Sydney, I saw sunstruck sandstone, gum trees with skin like elephants. I was in driver heaven. It was exactly at this point we first heard an engine roar. Not a truck, but something big. It sounded like a tractor doing 100 miles an hour. It was then we saw him pass, the bastard, the devil, like a wasp from a mud nest. Dan Bobbs, the enemy of my husband's happiness. Behind him came a police car, blue light flashing. Bastard. Bastard. I would have killed him if I could.
Chapter 2. I had written away for my own copy of the Red X rulebook and had also purchased an expensive Curta calculator to prepare for my role. The Bobbsies teased me about the book because they thought the rules so obvious, and as for the Curta calculator, they had never heard of such a thing. The Curta was beautiful in the way of a Zeiss lens, and was a thing I would not normally have had any excuse to buy. Fortunately, the Red X was a contest where average speeds were everything. As the officials kept saying, it was not a race, but a grueling test of machinery in the outback conditions. That is, we must prove our car reliable. If we arrived a minute early, we lost points. Ditto if we came in late. The purpose of the Curta was to constantly recalculate the speed required to arrive on time. I entered the prescribed average speed, official mileage, odometer reading, corrected speed in miles per minute. No one joked about it in the end. The rulebook decreed that reliability was the only issue. There could be no major rebuilds of engine, transmission, chassis or suspension. Components were sprayed with a special paint visible under a mercury vapour lamp. There were scrutineers waiting for us everywhere, as annoying as policemen in their way. As for the police themselves, they hated us. They knew what the rulebook would not admit, that the drivers were all maniacs, gathered to race, to burn each other off, to do the ton, to get ahead, to make up time, to sometimes create breathing space for adjustments and repairs, but always, no matter what they said in interviews, to make the other fella eat my dust. We entered Sydney at 30 miles per hour.
Chapter 3. Neither Titch nor I had ever been to Sydney. Don't laugh. We'd never seen the harbour, the bridge, a Bondi tram, a ferry. Never even bought a pound of prawns. As my husband told the street photographer, we were business maggots from Bacchus Marsh. We ate oysters Kilpatrick for the first time. We almost forgot what we had come for. It was a shock, in late afternoon, to stroll into the Sydney showground and see what we were up against. 267 hardened competitors, armoured with massive bull bars, done up in war paint, arranged on the dirt speedway ring inside the parade ground. Lex Davison, Jack Brabham, all the cracks had gathered to the fray. The press were there, camera flashes erupting in dense clusters like a battlefield. A cat could look at a king, We dropped in on Jack Davies' crew. He said, "Hi-ho, everybody," like he does on radio. Two cars over was a swarm of flashbulbs dying for the fame. It was Dan Bob still in the race, with his false teeth and his false smile, and his arm around two pretty girls, the Women's Weekly crew. "Gotta hand it to him," his son said. "He doesn't give up." Give up, throw up. In the rubbish bin, I found the morning's newspapers. Mad dash for starting line. Mr. Bobs had hit a stone and damaged the back plate on his differential, which lost its oil. In Benalla, he filled the diff with heavy oil and made a dash for Mittagong, where the new differential was fitted. He made up lost time thanks to Sergeant Cody and Constable Withers of the Highway Patrol, who had escorted the former aviator to the showgrounds, where he had admirers waiting to assist. Dan Bobs, I read, was well known to the motoring fraternity. I don't think this was true. He was also a wily prankster, a joker, a character, suspected of playing pranks with Jellignite in previous car trials, a habit which had him named Dangerous Dan. The reporter had learned of the existence of a second driver, Mr. Sullivan, my little Englishman, according to Dan Bobs, and also revealed the former aviator had a daughter-in-law in Holden No. 92. "Women can wear overalls all they like," Bobs said, "but they can't teach their father-in-law to suck eggs." He reportedly had little patience for women cluttering up the contest. "Don't worry about it," my husband said. "Forget it." As usual, he did not understand his father would destroy us any way he could. Bakuba found a boarding house, 10 minutes from the starting line. The landlord had had a stroke and would not give up his best chair by the wireless. As we could not hear the ABC news, the landlady undertook to provide the papers in the morning for a shilling each. Likewise, we were refused the use of her telephone, and I was forced back into the showground, where the red phone boxes were lined up by the toilets, offering a full view of the only person I did not wish to see. Dan, surrounded by his subjects, removed his hat and bowed to me. There were a mob of drivers crowded around the telephone boxes, rattling loose change in their pockets, as if their private parts were made of silver. These same jokers thought it amusing I was wearing overalls. I did not care. I waited. It was only when I got to the phone I saw that my father-in-law was in the next-door box, making a show of saluting me. I turned my back and heard Ronnie had gone down the shops to buy lemonade, and Beverly was still at the hairdresser. Dan was now kneeling, tying up his boots, not caring about who might be waiting to call their wife. I ignored him in favour of Edith, who needed help with the recipe for golden syrup dumplings. We were just mixing in the butter when there was an enormous bang. I did not know what world I was in. Dan's phone box jumped in the air. It fell over on its side. I saw the receiver lying on the grass. My phone was dead. Poor Edith, I thought. Poor little girl. I ran into a shower of flashbulbs blinding me. I was in tears when I got back to Titch. I told him his father tried to kill me. I was told to relax. Blowing up toilets was Dad's favourite trick. Did he kill me? No, he didn't. If he had wanted to, he would have. I lay awake for hours and hours, thinking my husband should stick up for me. I woke to find my photograph on the front page. An ugly woman in overalls, her mouth like a torn rag. Red X starts with a bang. I was Irene Bobbs, co-driver of Holden No. 92. I was, by sheer coincidence, the daughter-in-law of Dangerous Dan Bobbs. At the time of yesterday's explosion, Mr. Dan Bobbs had been in serious conversation with Sergeant Dick Worthington of the New South Wales Police. The two men were some considerable distance from the telephone booths involved. The reporters had already used up all the male contestants. They went off to Granny Conway, car number 28, who was very pleased to give her opinion of me. I should quit pranking. I should wear a skirt. I should drive carefully, and then I wouldn't need to copy all the men who raced ahead to make repairs before the checkpoint. The journos found me working on our vehicle. Would I comment? No, I wouldn't. My father-in-law had a low opinion of women drivers. What did I think of that? Seeing how he tried to blow me up, I said, he must be a bit worried. Did I plan to beat him, they wished to know. I said I would destroy him. If I'd been a footballer, that would have been okay. But now I got us named the Feuding Bobs. Titch, it seemed, heard none of this. He wanted to buy me a pretty dress for the photographers, but we had to attend a road safety lecture by the Road Safety Council and the Police Traffic Branch. We checked air, tyres, water, oil, and tightened everything that might shake loose. I put on some lippy for the photographers who never came. The front seat must be adjusted to the driver's legs, so the navigator must conform, and Bakuba's knees were therefore bent and pushed against the dashboard, where they would be locked in place for 18 days. He was hard at work with a tricky gadget, calculating how to maintain the 22 miles per hour average required. We departed at ordered intervals of 1 minute, after which we must suffer the hysteria of the New South Wales police. Being forced by law to crawl, we were overtaken by Sunday drivers and hoons and lowered Holdens with three-quarter grind camshafts. Their younger brothers manipulated the crossing lights to make us stop and sign their autograph books. Bakuba began updating instructions based on his Kurta calculator. We saw the sea at Newcastle, and then were winding through the bush, overtaking semi-trailers. Then the country changed, and slow brown rivers looped and snaked across the gaudy green. There was heavy rain between Taree and Coffs Harbour, then pineapples and bananas, like in a foreign country with bright green hills, the highway as muddy as a pig paddock. The locals turned peevish and changed the road signs, but credit where credit was due, the Kurta was a beauty. Titch drove, I drove. The navigator was calm and level. I checked us into Brisbane, 600 miles of Sunday driving. Titch had fortunately missed my comments to the Sydney Press. That night I dreamed I had a baby, which the court ruled must be taken from me. They would not say my crime.
Chapter 4. This was the tropics and all that suggests. For hundreds of sweaty miles I had breathed Mrs. Bobsey's neck, her familiar sister skin. It was a cruel road of boulders, dry creeks, tidal creeks, ruts, deep holes, scrubby floodplain, a few hills, although the toughest obstacle was sorting out the confusion caused by two conflicting official maps. In this schmozzle, 50 cars were unfairly penalised, and their crews lost 12 hours of rest time while they appealed injustice and ineptitude. My two drivers, on the other hand, were free to find a boarding house and telephone their kids. The navigator gained great kudos. Now it was time to sleep chastely beneath the cooling car. No one knew my dreams. With morning came the Bobsey husband, smooth-cheeked, fragrant with old spice and baby powder, his black hair flat across his perfect head. Did I sleep well? Like a madman, I did not say. "Good man," he said. "Today the road would be a nightmare. He had no need of average speeds." "What about secret checkpoints?" "F the secret checkpoints," he cried, pulling on his yellow chamois gloves. "Machinery would get murdered now," he said. The official map described the road as undulating, which meant it was a series of ramps which had the vehicle airborne half the time. It undulated its way through dreary subtropical brigalow, brownish grass, sleepy creeks whose murderous alter egos had previously ripped the banks apart and left jagged descents and rocky beds I would never have dared to drive across. I had the utmost confidence in Titch's ability, even though his eyes were only inches above the steering wheel. The map said water crossings and sudden drops,
and I kept my head on my shoulders as we slid and drifted with the wheel sliding through the driver's perfect yellow gloves. On a straight stretch of 2.5 miles, we were overtaken by Frank Kleinig in a Peugeot 203. Then the Humber Super Snipe Works team, who were nice enough to wave. Mrs. Bobsey forced a stop. She was concerned about a blowout due to increased tyre pressure in the heat. They released 40 pounds. Husband, two tyres, wife, the rest. We were overtaken by Ken Tubman's team. Now Mrs. Bobsey was at the wheel. She had a lovely bump on her nose. She reported the old bugger was on our tail. Let him go. But hers was not a nose to yield. It's not a race, her husband said. We were in Tubman's dust, and Dan, the old grey shark, was charging at our rear. The road was narrow, bumpy, decorated with broken windscreen glass. It had spongy edges that I feared would roll us over. Titch was clutching the front seat with an eye peeled for kangaroos. Mrs. Bobsey's eyes were watery with dust or domestic issues. Titch said, "Let him pass, let him pass." "Bend into deep drain," I said. She got it perfectly, sliding gracefully to the side so the grey Plymouth edged slowly by. Her high collar travelled all the way below her buttons. Who would have guessed it would feel just like a dance, even with the dust and danger and her husband breathing in my ear? "Rough road, 0.9 miles, I said. I thought, this is it. This is my life at last. Then came a mighty percussion, and I recognised the brutal slap of Gelignite. My innards came into my mouth, and the whole rear end was smacked sideways across the road. "Controlled explosion," Titch said. "Take a joke." "Grid in two clicks." Now a corrugated road in the Plymouth's dust. I waited for the second explosion as we shook and rattled at 60 miles an hour, while Mrs. Bobsey shouted F and C and B and S like a woman giving birth. My Lord, she stirred me up. I would not have missed it for the world.
Chapter 5. By now, I thought, my reported comments to the Sydney journalists must be wrapped around fish and chips. If so, that was not enough to save me from my punishment. My husband had read the Sydney Press in Brisbane. He had not said a word. He had stewed in private for 400 miles. Not until we were dealing with overheated tyres did he judge it time to speak. He was disappointed, he said. It was not so much what I had said about his father. It was the damage I had done to the value of our name. This was why we were in the Red X, apparently. I had thought it was so he would have something to look forward to, but I must have been wrong. We were in the Red X to merchandise our famous brand. He stank of Dunstan. He said there was a knack in talking to reporters. It was one thing to criticise his father, but perhaps I could learn from Dan and how he used the newspapers. There was a definite art to it. Art, fart. He pulled the rug from under me and never knew what he'd done. We stopped at Tallulah, some place spelt like that approximately, just a few miles inland from a lovely beach I never saw. There was an abandoned petrol station and a working telephone box. It was in this place I discovered Ronnie had the measles. Beverly was waiting for the doctor's call, so please get off the phone. I asked my husband what we should do now. He said we had to make up time. They reckon Gladstone is the gateway to the wonders of the Great Barrier Reef. I remember the smokestacks and my despair on learning that the doctor had still not arrived in Bacchus Marsh. We were now 1,200 miles away from Ronnie. It was the day I drove the so-called horror stretch, well named for every minute of what lay ahead. The unexpected comfort came from Buckhuber. I was so grateful for his reassuring hand as we dropped down into a creek and slammed the armor-plated diff against the rocks. "Nicely played," he said. Then Titch was driving, pushing the speed. But he drifted wide around a bend and nearly hit Dan's Plymouth, on its roof in the middle of the sugarcane. "Don't stop," I thought. "We don't have that luxury." How bloody sad to feel him break. He was still his father's dog.
Chapter 6. The first Aboriginals I ever saw were rocking Dan's Plymouth back and forth.